Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist, in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. 2021 was another banner year for the military-industrial complex as U.S. Congress signed off on a new record $778 billion in spending for the Pentagon and related work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy. That was $25 billion more than the Pentagon had even asked for. It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on a Pentagon. That department's astronomical budget adds up, for instance, to more than four times the cost of the most recent version of Biden's Build Back Better plan, which sparked such horrified opposition from Senator Joe Manchin and other alleged fiscal conservatives. Naturally, they didn't blink when it came to lavishing ever more taxpayer dollars on the military-industrial complex. Opposing Build Back Better while throwing so much more money at the Pentagon marks the ultimate in budgetary and national security hypocrisy. The Congressional Budget Office has determined that if current trends continue, the Pentagon could receive a monumental $7.3 trillion plus over the next decade, more than was spent during the peak decade of the Afghan and Iraq wars, when there were up to 190,000 American troops in those countries alone. Sadly, all too periodically, Biden's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and contractors from Afghanistan hasn't generated even the slightest peace dividend. Instead, any savings from that war are already being plowed into programs to counter China, official Washington's budget-justifying threat of choice. And all of this despite the fact that the United States already spends three times as much as China on its military. The Pentagon budget is not only gargantuan, but replete with waste, from vast overcharges for spare parts to weapons that don't work at unaffordable prices to forever wars with immense human and economic consequences. Simply put, the current level of Pentagon spending is both unnecessary and irrational. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excesses of the Reagan military buildup. Such pricing horror stories didn't emerge from thin air. They came from the work of people like legendary Pentagon whistleblower Ernest Fitzgerald. He initially made his mark by exposing the Air Force's efforts to hide billions in cost overruns on Lockheed massive C-5A transport plane. At the time, he was described by former Air Force Secretary Warren Orr as the most hated man in the Air Force. Fitzgerald and other Pentagon insiders became sources for Dina Racer, a young journalist who began drawing the attention of the media and congressional representatives to spare parts overcharges and other military horrors. In the end, she formed an organization, the Project on Military Procurement, to investigate and expose waste, fraud, and abuse. It would later evolve into the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, the most effective current watchdog when it comes to Pentagon spending. A recent POGO analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of TransDigm, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%. Yes, you read that figure right. On routine items. The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons they don't need at prices they can't afford. Systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance the safety and security of Americans. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating those planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of F-35 was to build a plane that in several variations would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at POGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. And its failures are too numerous to recount here. But a few examples should suffice to suggest why the program minimally needs to be scaled back in a major way, if not canceled completely. For a start, though meant to provide air support for troops on the ground, is proved anything but well designed to do so. In fact, that job is already handled far better and more cheaply by existing A-10 Warthog attack aircraft. A 2021 Pentagon assessment of the F-35, and keep in mind that this is the Department of Defense, not same outside expert, found 800 unresolved defects in the plane. Typical of its never-ending problems, a widely expensive and not particularly functional high-tech helmet, which at a cost of $400,000 each, is meant to give its pilot a special awareness of what's happening around and below the plane as well as to the horizon. And don't forget that the F-35 will be staggeringly expensive to maintain and already cost an impressive $38,000 an hour to fly. Unbelievably enough, the U.S. covered a globe military strategy, including a planet-wide footprint of more than 750 military bases, more than 200,000 troops stationed overseas, huge and costly aircraft carrier task forces eternally floating the seven seas, and a massive nuclear arsenal that could destroy life as we know it, with thousands of warheads to spare. You only need to look at the human and economic costs of America's post-9/11 wars to grasp the utter folly of such a strategy. According to Brown University's Cost of War project, the conflicts waged by the United States in this century have cost $8 trillion and counting, with hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties, thousands of U.S. troops killed and hundreds of thousands more suffering from traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. And for what? In Iraq, the U.S. cleared the way for a sectarian regime that then helped create the conditions for Daesh to sweep in and conquer significant parts of the country, only to be repelled but not thoroughly defeated at a great cost in lives and treasure. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, after conflict doomed as soon as it morphed into an exercise in nation-building and larger-scale counterinsurgency, the Taliban is now in power. It's hard to imagine a more ringing indictment of the policy of endless war. Despite the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, spending on global counter-terror operations remains at high levels. Thanks to ongoing missions by special operations forces, repeated airstrikes, ongoing military aid and training, and other kinds of involvement short of full-scale war. Given the opportunity to rethink a strategy as part of a global force posture review released late last year, the Biden administration opted for a remarkably status quo approach, insisting on maintaining substantial bases in the West Asia-North Africa region, while modestly boosting the U.S. troop presence in East Asia. Despite the immediate headlines about spending on sending troops and planes to Eastern Europe and weapons to Ukraine in response to Russia's massing of its forces on that country's borders, the dominant narrative for keeping the Pentagon budget at its current size remains China. It matters little that the greatest challenges posed by America are political, economic, and military. The National Defense Strategy Commission, a congressionally mandated body charged with critiquing the Pentagon's official strategy document, drew more than half its members from individuals on the boards of arms-making corporations, working as consultants for the arms industry or from think tank heavily funded by just such contractors. Not surprisingly, the commission called for a 3% to 5% annual increase in a Pentagon budget into foreseeable future. Follow that blueprint and you are talking $1 trillion annually by the middle of this decade, according to an analysis by Taxpayers for Common Sense. Such an increase, in other words, would prove sustainable in a country where so much else is needed, but that won't stop Pentagon budget hawks from using it as their North Star. In March of this year, the Pentagon expected to release both its National Defense Strategy and its budget for 2023. There are a few small glimmers of hope, like reports that the administration may abandon certain dangerous and unnecessary nuclear weapons program instituted by the Trump administration. However, the true challenge crafting a budget that addresses genuine security problems like public health and the climate crisis would require fresh thinking and persistent public pressure to slash the Pentagon budget while reducing the size of the military-industrial complex. Without a significant change, of course, 2022 will once again be a banner year for Lockheed Martin and other top weapons makers at the expense of investing in programs necessary to combat urgent challenges from pandemics to climate change to global inequality.
American families,
Addie is 19 years old. She was born in a village in Ethiopia. At the age of 11, after spending some time in an orphanage, she was adopted by a couple from Ohio. Her biological mother hoped to give her a better future. Instead, the story of Addie became the same odyssey as that of hundreds of children adopted by American families, and then, after a few months or years, abandoned and transferred to other families. An exchange of children that takes place absolutely privately, in the shadows, outside the control of authorities. A black market of adoptions.
Cases started to surface in the news a few years ago. It's a practice that's gone on for a long time, but it's become a lot more serious in the last 10 or 15 years because of the way the internet has been used to transfer kids, really in some cases, to total strangers. Probably the most disturbing trend and the thing that we're the most concerned about right now is that the internet has become a place where potentially predatory people hold themselves out as families looking to help children. And so you'll see cases where children are transferred by a family no longer willing or able to care for them to a complete stranger without any kind of vetting, without any kind of background check. And oftentimes the child is just put on a plane or put on a bus or dropped off in a parking lot to someone that the family met on the internet, but they have no personal real-world relationship with.
To adopt a child in America, all you need is a few clicks on the internet. In the meanders of the web, one can find anything. Facebook pages, blogs, specialized websites, people who want to get rid of adopted children, or people who want to find one. And they find one through photos, publicity ads for little human beings.
Sean is 10 years old. He was adopted 4 years ago in Africa. We are looking for a new family because of his difficulty in bonding with his adopted parents. Jillian's adoption is not going well. She cannot overcome refusal and hostility towards her adoptive mother. Jacob needs a new adoption and a new family where he can learn to accept his siblings.
With an all-American hypocrisy, they call them second chance adoption, a second opportunity. If the first adoption doesn't work, that's the philosophy. Who knows, maybe it will work out the second time.
In cases like adoption, even in temporary placement, or even just temporary placement with a friend or family member, you can have an attorney or you can download off the internet a document that says, I'm going to delegate to you my rights and responsibilities, and as long as I have two witnesses and a notary sign this document, I hand the document to whomever I'm giving that rights and responsibilities to, and as long as they keep this document, they can typically make decisions on behalf of the child.
Christine Thurman is an attorney specialized in second chance adoptions. This practice, that is the exchange of children, is absolutely legal in America. To transfer parental authority, one needs only sign a document of a few pages, or even just a few paragraphs.
You can execute a limited durable power of attorney, two witnesses, two individuals, as well as a notary public, which is someone authorized to sign legal documents who's taken a small test and paid a small fee. They execute the document, they'll hand it over to the individual receiving the document. It is not recorded with a clerk of court, it does not go in front of a judge. It is an informal, it's a formal document, but it's an informal process. There's no filing requirement.
It's like a receipt?
It's just like a receipt.
For a kid?
For a child.
But how is it possible that in America, children are exchanged as if they were objects? James Langvin is a member of Congress for the state of Rhode Island. A Democrat, for years has been fighting to put an end to the shame of second chance adoptions. But until the present, with poor results.
There are laws on the books to prevent rehoming, But a lot of times, because these rehomings actually happen under the radar, it's very difficult to track down and to prove that that it's become challenging for law enforcement to actually get their arms around how often this is happening, and then actually tracking it down and doing more to protect these children. Not only enforcing the law and trying to bring more clarity and compliance with people who have adopted children and making sure that they can't just easily transfer custody of a child under the radar screen to another family or another individual. We also need to provide the support services that families need so the adoption doesn't fail in the first place. That would be, I think, the best step forward.
The mom, in the beginning, we were fine. After a year later, she's showing the real person who she is and becoming more angrier, punishes me really hard, really bad, the point where I am like not even part of the family. Most of the times I'll be in the basement by myself, and when she cooks the dinner, I would love to come upstairs and eat with them, and I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to stay in the basement and, you know, just stay there, stare at the walls, basically. I did that for a couple months, and that was the worst day of my life, honestly. I never want anybody go through that.
We fly to Florida, destination Orlando, the Disney World city. Marianne Hewitt is the founder of Love and Hope Adoptions. Her agency deals with consulting and international adoptions, and also second chance adoptions. For many couples, the easiest, quickest, and cheapest way to obtain a child.
There was a family that called us. They were in a panic because there was a show about some of those groups that people were talking on getting shut down. Yahoo didn't know. They were just adoption groups. People were supposed to innocently be talking, and people started to swap their kids. And they called in a panic, oh, those groups are shutting down. We're not going to be able to adopt. You know, we need to adopt through you. And I was like, well, they called because I had a situation. And I said, okay, well, we need this, we need that. Oh, no, our state doesn't need that. I'm like, of course it does. No, we don't need ICPC. I'm like, yes, you do. And then you have to do the post visits. Oh, no, we don't. I'm like, yes, you do. So they didn't want to follow what has to be done, and I didn't work with them. But I have not forgotten them because they have adopted a lot of children just reaching out to people online and not following the legal process. And all the children they've adopted are all children that are a bit disabled emotionally and mentally, which tells me they can even more easily take advantage of them. I just had this feeling it wasn't out of the goodness of their heart because they truly did not want to follow the process.
But sometimes second chance adoptions have a happy ending. In this farm, on the outskirts of Tallahassee in Florida, Shannon and Brian Carroll live with their seven children, adopted in the last 5 years. For them, saving children in difficulty and with past experiences of abandonment or failed adoptions is a mission, a way of fulfilling the will of God.
Lord, we come to you to thank you for today. Thank you for the service that we saw today with prayer. Thank you for our family in general. Amen.
If you're trying to build a family through adoption, if adoptive parents say, oh, I wasn't able to have babies, or we just want one more kid, we're just going to get this fun little kid from China and we're going to build our family, I think you'll find out really fast that these little babies, these kids from traumatic relationship, these children raised in orphanages, they don't know how to act with a mommy and a daddy. They've never had one. They're not going to just come into the house and be like, oh, hi, mom, I love you. If we're adopting these kids to fill a need within ourselves, a need for our kids to love us, it's not going to happen. But if we're adopting these kids to fill a need within them, to be loved, whether they want to be or not, then that's when they can find healing.
Among Carol's seven children, there is Samuel, 9 years old, his face disfigured by a birthmark. He was abandoned when he was 6 months old by his parents. Sam spent his first 4 years in an orphanage in China before being adopted by a family in Michigan. After 4 years, in 2014, this family decided to get rid of him, abandoned once again.
They're like, we need to talk to you. Can you head to your room? So then I'm like, what's it about? When I'm thinking in my mind, oh, it's probably nothing too big. Then I realized, oh, okay. You think, okay, I'm here just to, I'm going to be here to stay forever. But the next thing you know, oh, I have to move. Then after a while, you can't really trust them if they say, you're going to stay here for the rest of your life. Because you're like, well, I already got moved around this many times. So I guess I can't really trust them. I just had to wait it out and see.
One of the things that Sam first said when he moved here is, oh, maybe my next family will be in Texas. Maybe my next family will be in California. It was just this exciting adventure. But, you know, adventures are only exciting for a season. And eventually he's going to want a family. That he's going to want to know that somebody wanted him. So we had to kind of tell him, hey, kid, no matter how much you like us, you're here forever. We're it. Last stop. There's no other family. It's us.
Addie spent 6 years with her second adoptive family in Wisconsin. Actually, it was a sort of orphanage more than a family. 18 children of all ages. Last year, as soon as she turned 18, she was abandoned again. Another traumatic experience.
The mom always says to me, you need to move. It was all about the moving, move, move. And I told her, you know, I can't move. I don't have any money to go or, you know, I didn't have a resource. And I asked her if I could stay longer. And so it was very difficult for her to say yes and you could stay because she truly wanted me to get out and move so she can get another kid in my spot. They always assured me that won't happen, but they didn't stick with their words still too. So it's just really upsetting to have that, you know, I thought somebody that you cared and that will love you and, you know, that won't do something like that.
Addie found herself drifting without knowing what to do, where to go. Karen Bass is a Democrat MP from California. When she found out about Addie's situation, she decided to help her financially and above all, find her a new home, this time in Los Angeles.
I only know her story, which she said that the house she was living in, the parents decided they wanted new children. They wanted new children! And so they put her out and they put another 18-year-old out and they went to the Ukraine and brought two new children. I connected her with the Ethiopian community in Los Angeles, which is a large constituency in my district. And they found a place for her to live. She's in a job training program now or about to enter a job training program. And I think she's in a very good situation with the community that has embraced her.
Today, Addie lives with Wasi, who is also of Ethiopian origin, hoping that Addie can find her own way and overcome the traumas of her past. Also, thanks to the contacts found again after years of silence with her biological mother in Ethiopia.
I asked every time, God, why is this happening to me? I just wanted to end this, and why can this pain go away? For years, I went through that pain. The whole thing I've been through all the years is just all punching me in the face, you know? It's just all bad stuff happening. And I just like, what could go better? This is all bad. I just want to just end it, and then life will be better for everybody if Addie's not in this earth. I always had a hope because of my family. honestly, that's the only thing that kept my head saying, no, don't do it, don't do it. Because I kept dreaming that I wanted to kill myself or doing something really stupid to myself that I would. But I know I would be very selfish because I know my mother and my sibling that loves me, that they will be devastated. So I cannot give that to my family. That really kept me saying, no, 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 no.
But if Addie made it, the destiny of hundreds of children who have had second chance adoptions, gone from family to family, is unknown. There is no data bank, no census, no statistics. Children disappear into thin air, sold, exchanged, swallowed up by a system that is shameful in a civilized society.
In some states, I would say that it is actually far more difficult to adopt a dog than it is to adopt a child. And in fact, one of the things that I've pointed out to Congress is that almost every animal rescue program that I've surveyed actually requires the person adopting the animal to report back to that agency. They are not permitted to rehome the animal. But there are very few restraints in the adoption of children that parallel that animal welfare approach.
We found in some cases that children that have been rehomed have gone to people with criminal records, in some cases even individuals who have had other children taken away from them for a variety of reasons. They've lost their own, their child and taken away because of abuse-related issues, and then they are able to get another child through this rehoming process. That's pretty outrageous.
We've seen cases where children go missing via the internet. They say they're going to a family member and they go missing. They're in the paper. Human trafficking, that these cases set up a very easy scenario for human trafficking of children. You have an individual decide he's going to or she's going to adopt these children, and they get them in their home, and where they go after that, there's no tracking. There's no oversight. There's no follow-up. Unlike if you were to adopt a dog, you might have some follow-up care. You might have a microchip, and I'm not ever suggesting children should be microchipped, but there is no follow-up. We never know what happens to these children.
Because of the experience, honestly, I went through, now I feel like I might not be a good mother, which is so sad because someday I want to be a mother. I always, when I was a little girl, I played with dolls and stuff before this stuff happened to me. But now I'm experiencing not so good things as in what I seen. A mom can be very mean and very hard on a kid. So now I experience that. I feel I'm a fear that I might not be a good mother. I want my future be happy. I want to be happy and someday bring all my family, my mom, my sister, my brothers, all live in one big house.
Felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. This modern ignorance is not the same everywhere in the world. In my opinion, one clear and complete example of modern ignorance is the US. This form of ignorance is more serious and severe than anywhere else in the world. This is the case in the true sense of the word. The US is a regime which promotes indecent conduct, in which discrimination is exacerbating on a daily basis, and in which national wealth is increasingly flowing towards the wealthy and rich. A country as rich as the US is in a situation that people die on the streets if the weather becomes cold. And when it becomes hot, people also lose their lives on the street. Why? What does this mean? Today, the embodiment of modern ignorance, discrimination, oppression, and generation of crisis in the world is the US.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Basically, the United States regime is a crisis-making and crisis-feeding regime. They feed off crisis. They nourish off the various crises that occur in the world. It is such a regime. There are networks of mafia power in the US, and these networks feed off and take advantage of the crises that occur throughout the world. The US is basically a mafia regime. The United States is a mafia regime. Political, economic, and weapons manufacturing mafia. There are all sorts of mafias which control and manipulate the politics of that country. Behind the scenes of governments, they bring individuals to power and oust some from power. Such mafias install presidents. These mafia cartels and this mafia regime need crisis to exist throughout the world. Therefore, they create centers of crisis. Notice how many crises they created in West Asia. The Americans even felt the need to give birth to a creature called Daesh, or ISIS, which was their trained dog. This creature was trained to publicly film the beheading, burning, and drowning of individuals. It was the US that created this creature. They themselves acknowledged that they created that creature. They are the generators of crisis.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public. France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election. But regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip, as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented, and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest, as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdoud. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states, as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround For in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticised for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque, to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.